Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine Podcast Radio. You're about to listen to an episode of Tech Done Different Podcast with Ted Harrington. Do you follow the pack or challenge the status quo? Join Ted as he explores how to succeed by going against conventional wisdom. You'll hear leaders in technology and security tell stories about how they achieve their success by doing things differently. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Tech Done Different. I'm your host, Ted Harrington, and with me here today is my special guest, Peter Harris. Peter, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Ted.
So I asked Peter to be on the show because he comes to us from the viewpoint of the money side, right? So many of our listeners here work in technology or even within the security realm of that, and either already have or want to raise outside capital. And so I thought, well, hey, let's get somebody who does that for a living, but not just anybody. Let's get somebody who approaches that a little bit differently. So Peter, maybe a place to start would be, you were talking about how you're, when you and I were talking, not yet on this episode, you were talking about how you guys approach what you guys do, investing in companies, slightly differently. So maybe let's start there. If you could just give that brief introduction. And in particular, what I'd like you to narrow in on is, what did you see that was broken about the way things currently worked? Or maybe broken is too strong of a word, but you saw something that said, we got to do it differently. What was it that you saw? And why did you want to do it differently?
Yeah, it's a great question. So yeah, let me tell you a little bit about our fund. So the fund is called the University Growth Fund. You can look us up online. It's ugrowthfund.com. And you know, the way I describe our fund is there's kind of two sides of the house. So one side is the traditional investment side, right? We manage about $50 million in assets. We co-invest alongside some of the top venture and private equity funds across the country. We make investments as early as like a Series A. So when a company is doing, you know, 1 to 3 million in revenue, all the way up to pre-IPO deals where they're doing, you know, hundreds of millions in revenue. So pretty broad range. And then we also invest across a wide range of sectors as well. So enterprise software, consumer tech, we've done some consumer products, fintech, semiconductor, et cetera. The other part of our fund that really makes us unique is our student program. And that's what the university in our name really relates to. So at any given time, we have 30 to 50 students across 8 different universities. We put those students through a very rigorous training program. But then the idea is to give those students as much autonomy as possible. So rather than having them get the coffee, my partner and I, we literally get the coffee. We do the Costco runs to make sure that there's enough snacks in the break room. And really, it's about empowering students to get real world experience. And what we found is that when you do that, students, just like anybody, you know, you set the right expectations, you provide the support, and they rise to the occasion. And they do great. They do great work, both on the due diligence side, as well as like helping us make investment decisions and support our portfolio companies. So hopefully that gives you at least a high level snapshot of who we are and what makes us different. The reason why, you know, we love how we are different is that if you look at venture capital today and how it's evolved over the last couple decades, it used to be that getting access to venture capital is very hard, right? There were only a handful of funds that had enough money to invest. And you know, you kind of had to tap into those networks to get access to that capital. And so VCs really had the upper hand in a lot of cases. And the other thing is there wasn't a lot of information about how to raise a venture fund or a round of venture capital. But today, like the internet has like made tons of resources available. There are lots and lots of funds managing, you know, tens or hundreds or billions of dollars. And so there's a lot of access to capital. And so we've been thinking about like, how do we differentiate ourselves, right? From other providers of capital, right? what can we do to be unique? And, you know, our student program, frankly, is one way in which we do that. So when we go into an entrepreneur, it's not just, hey, we've got a check. Can we write some money into your company? Smart entrepreneurs are asking themselves, what can this investor bring to me beyond the check, right? And the way we answer that is through our students. So one, entrepreneurs that let us invest are helping provide this really rich experiential education for students, which is unique. But then two, you know, every entrepreneur is trying to get 100 things done, right? And, you know, the people in your audience probably can relate to that. And we don't promise that we can even help on the top 50, but we're positive on the bottom 50. There's a bunch of things that aren't getting done that we could throw a team of really bright, motivated students to crank on and help with. And in doing that, we end up like providing this value that's very complementary to the other investors, because the other investors tend to be really good at other things like, oh, you need to bring in a new chief marketing officer. Well, let me tap into my network and help you find that person. Or you're trying to think through this acquisition scenario. You know, I've been through that 10 other times in other startups. I can help you with that. And so that way it ends up being like a very complementary partnership all the way around with the company, the other investors, and our firm.
Wow, that's really fascinating to hear that approach. If you think about, you know, probably everybody's seen Shark Tank at some point, and so I'm way simplifying. Obviously, your business is a little different, but in some ways, I guess there's some similarities. But it's funny when you see, you know, these different entrepreneurs come and pitch, and so many of them, what they're always asking for is like, beyond the money, can you, you know, I want to work with, you know, Damon, or I want to work with, you know, it doesn't matter, any of them, because sure, they think sure. They might bring access to something. And it sounds like what I'm hearing you say is that you've found a way to give that entrepreneur like, hey, resources, in addition to money, we're going to give you people, while at the same time, sort of building that next level of the workforce that's going to be in the investing community. Is that a correct way to think about it?
Yeah, no, exactly. Yep. That's cool. Kind of our goal. So, you know, one of the things I think a lot about is, whenever I'm approaching different partnerships or ideas, like how can we create that win-win-win, right? Like kind of like what you just articulated, which is how can we make it win for every party, so that everyone's getting something out of it?
Yeah, it certainly seems to be working that way. And I want to key in on one of the leadership principles that you just described. This might have to be the title of this episode, but the you said, I wrote it down because it was so good. You said, we get the coffee. And that really, that pushed a good button for me, because you could absolutely do the opposite and say, oh, the beauty of having all these interns is I don't have to do anything. Like, you wash my car and you do this. And a lot of leaders actually do that. So tell me about, how did you arrive at sort of this way of thinking about how this sort of servant leadership that you're describing, how it's your job to make sure that the students can deliver value?
Yeah, so I think it really goes back to when I was a student. So, you know, when I was a student, I joined our predecessor fund, which was very similar to the one we're running today. It was called the University Venture Fund. And when I came on, the guys that had started the fund left, and they brought in this new guy who's now my business partner in this fund. And, you know, he was fresh to it. I was relatively fresh. And we kind of like tackled the whole problem of what to do now with this fund, where the founders have left together. And together we built out the material, you know, our due diligence processes and our deal sourcing processes and our, you know, managing our investors' processes, like all of those things, and then worked on deals together. And what I found for myself personally is I was so invigorated and willing to like pull all-nighters and just crank and give it my all when I felt like I had like true ownership, right? Over something that was like valuable to me, right? To gain that, you know, the valuable part for me was actually gaining that experience. And so like I went well above and beyond. And so now that I'm kind of on the flip side of that as more of the boss, if you will, I'm constantly thinking about, if I really want the very best out of my people, my students, right, what can I do to really like create that rich experience for them? And invariably, like having them get my coffee is not a rich experience, right? It's not helping them achieve their goals. It's not building them up. It's not trusting them. It's not giving them autonomy. It's not all of these things that I think, you know, we inherently know are real drivers to and motivators, right? And yet, like, it's really easy to just be like, oh, you know what? I really don't want to do this thing. Can I just like offload it onto somebody else? And so it's just this like constant, like, I don't, that's not really what they signed up for. So I'm not going to have them do that. I'll take that on myself and do that. Or I'll find somebody else outside of our internship program to do that. So that I can ensure like the program is really focused on really high value things for our students to work on.
That's amazing. So are these students, are they undergraduate or are they grad students?
It's a mix. It's about 2/3 undergrad and a third grad student. And it's actually not a lot of MBAs. We maybe have one or two MBAs. It's mostly law students and PhD students.
Oh, so. Interesting. Yeah, it's really interesting, you know, me personally. This is one of the fun parts about hosting a podcast. It's like I get to invite people on and say, well, I have this problem. Can you answer this problem for me? And then the audience gets to hear the answer too. It's funny hearing you talk about your internship program, because we're a big believer in internship programs too, probably for a lot of the same reasons that you are. And so I'll state, these are the things that we like about interns. And are these the same things that you see? And this is why you might be interested in these type of people. But when we see interns, what we like is that they, you know, raw talent, they maybe don't have the experience or even the specific skills yet, but they have the foundation and they have, you know, we often refer to them as aptitude hires, where it's this person has the aptitude to grow into the kind of person we want. Let's take that aptitude and shape them the way we want and not have to deal with all the sort of bad habits that might come with, you know, a more seasoned person. Is that the kind of things that you're looking for? If so, or even if not, like, what is it that you're looking for that might be similar or different?
Yeah, so it's a good question. So, you know, when you think about venture capital, how many people actually have any experience in venture capital? Like, not very many. And then you add on top of the fact that they're students, so they're even less likely to have any like real experience. So it's not that like we can go and look at these interns and say, oh, well, we're just going to pick the ones that have like a ton of experience to bring to the table, because nobody has it. And so this is what I tell applicants, is I look for three things. I look for people that are really smart, because in venture capital, invariably, the thing that's great about it is also one of the biggest challenges, and that is that you constantly have to be learning. You're evaluating new business models, new technologies, meeting new people. Like, it is just a constant flow of new information. And so you got to get up those learning curves quickly, because you have to make, you know, million-dollar decisions in a very short time period. We also look at or look for people that are super passionate about something related to what we do. It doesn't even have to be venture capital specifically, but it's got to be like entrepreneurship or technology or investing. Because at the end of the day, like, I can force feed people information, but they're really not going to love it. They're not going to do a great job, and they're not going to be thinking about it, you know, while they're in the shower, before they go to sleep, or while they're eating their cereal, right? And pushing themselves to kind of continue to learn and approach things from a different perspective. And then the last thing is everything we do is in teams. So we look for people that are good team players. They pull their weight, they communicate, you know, they're not a drag or dead weight on the team. And we just figure if an individual has those three things, we can get them up the learning curve and help them become a great investor. If they lack any one of those three things, it's going to be a real challenge to get them there.
It sounds like the three things that you just identified, and then of course the things that domino out from them, like, in order to be, you need to be smart because you need to excel, you need to learn things quickly, et cetera. But those three things almost sound like just universal hiring decisions that build great teams. Find smart people who are passionate and work great in a team dynamic. So right there alone. I mean, that's a great insight that I think a lot of people could take away. But I want to let's switch gears a little bit and let's talk about some of your portfolio companies. And sure. You know, don't have to name names or anything, but it would be fun to dive into different things that you've seen. So maybe let's start by talking about companies that you've seen do it right. And there's obviously a lot of people that listen to a show like this are themselves either already have outside capital or are seeking it. And they're probably dying to know, like, what are the things that I should be doing once I get money in order to make sure that I make the best use of that money and go succeed? So there's probably at some point when you invest in a company, you say, hey, do these three things and you'll be successful, or whatever it is you do. How should you think about advising companies that want to succeed like those in your portfolio companies?
Yeah, that's a great question. Man, if I knew the three things that every company had to do to be successful.
I was hoping today was the day we were going to crack the code.
Look, I think it depends at every stage, but I'll tell you some pitfalls. And these are similar things that I tell my students when they're doing due diligence. Is, you know, like, understand the pain point that you are solving. So oftentimes we'll meet with entrepreneurs and, you know, there are a lot of reasons to start a company and there are a lot of bad reasons to start a company. And a lot of those bad reasons are around like, well, I want to get rich, you know, or what have you. The best reasons, in my opinion, are the ones where you have experienced some pain, right? And you are on a mission to solve that pain for yourself and others, right? And so one of the things I love asking entrepreneurs is like, tell me about your origin story, right? Because that's what I'm waiting to hear is this pain point that they've experienced and that they understand that few other people do, and that, you know, they're so excited and passionate to solve it. And then the next piece really builds off of that, and that is, does your solution really solve that pain point? And what we've seen is the companies that really succeed at the end of the day are the ones that have figured out how to solve that pain point in such a way that customers are almost literally begging them for the solution. So I'll give you a case study. So we were an investor in our prior fund in a company called Instructure. They make a product called Canvas. And so if you've graduated from a university in the last little bit, there's a good chance you've used their product because it's a learning management system. It's a product that professors use to post grades and assignments and other things. So what was fascinating about that story is it was these two computer science students from Brigham Young University. They were in this class with this professor who was an entrepreneur that just sold his company and was kind of, you know, on the beach and teaching a class for fun kind of thing. And part of the assignment was go find some software that everybody hates to use. So they decided like LMS. Everybody hates using the LMS. It's garbage software. We can do better. And the professor told them, okay, great. If you really want to do this, go and talk to 50 CTOs and prove to me that this is really a problem. And if you do, then I'll consider investing. So most people at that point, right, would just kind of be like, that sounds like a lot of work. I'm not going to do it, blah, blah, blah. And that professor would never see him again. These two guys, they got in this beat up old car and they drove around the country that summer and they met with 35 CTOs of major universities. And they interviewed them and they came back and they just laid it out. And they were like, we were absolutely right. Like, everybody hates LMS at every different level, right? At the admin level, at the professor level, at the student level, like all the way down. And so then he said, this is really interesting. Now we need to figure out how do we solve this pain point, right? And so what they did is they built their entire product in a pitch deck, right? So they went around and met with all these CTOs again. And before writing a single line of code, they had the entire product kind of wireframed out in a pitch deck. And they didn't write their first line of code until they weren't getting any other feedback, right? Everybody was saying, wow, if you could do this, this would be perfect. We would buy it tomorrow, right? And so when they launched, there was so much demand for their product that it was almost like it didn't matter who you hired in sales, right? People were banging down the door to use it. And so when we're looking at companies, like, I'm constantly looking for that same type of solution to a massive pain point, right? Where it's like, it doesn't even matter who you hire almost. Like, people are, you're going to be able to sell a lot because people are just dying for that product.
That's such powerful and really timeless advice, right? To understand your the problem that you're solving and then make sure you actually solve it. And, you know, you see it all the time. The opposite is what's happening, where companies are like, oh, I can sell this thing. I know how to do this thing and our customers will buy it because it's the best, it's the fastest, whatever. And that doesn't necessarily always connect. But one of the other problems is people don't even know how to talk about it, right? If you look at most marketing websites, it's like, we do this, we do that, with no real mention of, like, it's implied maybe, but no real mention of the problem. And the way you just laid it out, which was, we're not doing anything until we understand the problem. And then it's like the solution sells itself. That's what a wonderful way to think about it. Would you say that it's common that, I mean, I know you're looking for that, so maybe in your case, that's most of what you see of the companies you invest in, but do you think it's common that people think about it that way?
No, honestly, I don't. Yeah. I think more often, right, it's like, oh, well, I saw kind of this problem and it seems like a lot of people have this problem. So I think I'll come up with a solution that I think would work for it, right? And they'll put something together. But that's very different from, like, you know, going out and almost building the product in a wireframe format with, you know, hundreds of customers before you ever even start, right? And really doing the homework. So there's this concept called, like, an earned secret, right? And I love that concept of, like, it's a secret. Nobody else really knows about it, largely because you had to put in the time and energy to learn it, right? It wasn't like there weren't other LMS products out there that were super well funded and so on and so forth. I think the big difference is that those companies in many cases got complacent and they weren't willing to do the work to really figure out what the pain point was and solve it at that point.
Do you think that that work, must it happen before a solution is built, or can someone who already has a built solution, can they go to their customers now and say, hey, tell me about the pain point that you have?
I think you can. But what I'll say is that the later down the road, the further down the road it is before you do that, the more painful it will be to make the pivot, right? So we have another company that they were growing super fast, but the problem was that they were solving a pain point that wasn't, you know, they thought they were solving one pain point, but in reality, they were solving this totally different pain point. And it took them a long time to figure out what the, like, one, they realized that the pain point they were actually solving for their customers was not a pain point. Those customers were not great customers, right? They were mostly small businesses. They churned off the platform really quickly. They didn't appreciate the value that was being created outside of the first time that they used the product. So there were a lot of challenges, and they spent a long time kind of in the wilderness working with a lot of different customers with their technology before they finally found a subsection of their customer base that really felt a really strong pain point. And now they've finally built out their product to really address that niche market. And they're starting to grow and do really well, but man, it was like 3 years of pain and suffering in the wilderness before they found that. And so there were times where I thought, man, like, should they just shutter this thing and start over, right? And to their credit, they didn't, and they persevered and really found that great niche. But how much better off would they have been, right, if they had understood that pain point and their customer base, like, better earlier on?
Yeah, that's pretty powerful. Most companies probably assume, right, that, oh, I know my customer, I talk to them all the time and they write me all these checks, but don't necessarily ask that sort of probing question where the customer says, well, I really actually hire your service or your product or whatever because of this other reason. It saves me time I don't care about that other thing that you talk about. It's like this little subset. I see that actually happen quite a bit. So that's good advice. So I'm a security guy. I know that you are, that's not your necessarily area of expertise, but I do want to ask you a couple questions from a security viewpoint that would be as an investor, I would like to understand how you think about security a little bit. So when you're looking to invest in a portfolio company, to what extent is the security of that solution considered during due diligence, or is it even considered?
So it depends. I would say there are varying levels. So if we're looking at like an e-commerce business, let's say, or consumer products business, right? It's almost like check the box. Like, are they doing kind of the basic normal things that you'd expect for an e-commerce business to be protecting their customers' data, et cetera, et cetera. but it doesn't really get a lot of attention. But as you go up that curve, right? So we were an investor in Fastly on the CDN side of things. And in that case, we did spend a decent amount of time trying to really understand the security side of their business because, you know, it's one thing if somebody steals, you know, some names, addresses, maybe even credit card information of a e-commerce consumer. That's horrible. Don't get me wrong, but it's a totally different thing, right? When somebody can hack into like Spotify, right? Because you're their CDN and you didn't do a good job on security, right? So it kind of varies based on the business and the level of threat that a port, you know, security implementation represents. But I will say, like, in the grand scheme of things, like, security probably doesn't carry as much weight as it probably should when doing due diligence.
That's interesting. Is that because it's, in your eyes, or the eyes, I guess, of the investing community, more of an emerging topic area? Or is that because even if you invest in a company and it gets like the worst possible security breach you could possibly imagine, that still doesn't really impact you that adversely? Like, why is it, do you think, the security doesn't raise to the very high level?
I think it's largely because security, to an extent, is kind of a black swan event, right? It's rare that until you reach a certain size, right? So you have to keep in mind too, that a lot of what we do from an investing perspective is smaller companies that aren't getting hit by, you know, hackers and other things on a consistent basis. And so it's just hard to evaluate the probabilities of that happening, right? On a startup. And it's also kind of like, well, there's all these other things that could also kill the business. So, you know, where do you put your time and energy and resources, right?
Sure. Yeah. You have to assess risk. I mean, you're doing that with every element of, is this business going to succeed? Will it actually hit our multiple? Can this management team actually deliver? What if maybe let's ask the question from the other perspective. If you were considering investing in a company or a handful of companies, and one of those companies could demonstrate to you their investment and adherence to security, you know, they could show you the types of testing they've done and how their platform actually, you know, performs from a security perspective. Would that make them in any way more interesting to you, or get a, you know, would you be willing to go with a higher valuation as you invest? How does the fact that someone can prove security influence your thinking in any way? Or does it?
So I would say, unless it's a true competitive advantage, it's going to be viewed as like table stakes, right? It's like, check the box. Like, are you doing what you need to do to like, to keep your data secure, et cetera, et cetera. But the flip side of that is, you know, going back to that pain point, if the security implementation and solution that they've developed really gives them something unique to talk about, and their customer, you know, really needs it, right? Because without it, they're exposing themselves to a lot of risk. then I think it makes a big difference, right? And could result in a much higher valuation, or at a minimum, like a lot more interest in investing in the company.
So that's pretty cool to hear. I wrote a book that just came out that one of the arguments that I make in the book, a central argument, is that security is actually a competitive advantage and I wrote it in the context of in the marketplace, as opposed to competitive advantage to get funding. And the reason for that is that there's sort of these competing factors going on. On one hand, you've got the buyers of these solutions, like the users, they want to use software that's secure. So that's one factor. The other factor is almost nobody knows how to talk about security at all. And so I wrote this book to say, look, here's how you secure it. And then here's how you prove it. And what I just heard you say is that, well, so let me finish that. So once you prove it, then that delivers you the competitive advantage. And what I just heard you say is once you have that competitive advantage, that's something that would be appealing. Like if you had a company come to you that said, here's how we go way above and beyond on security, this is why it matters to our customer, that would be something that you would see as a value worth a premium.
Yeah, absolutely. And to the extent that you can say, hey, look, this is something that none of our competitors are even thinking about, right? But here's where our customers have said repeatedly that it's critical to them, right? That to me is like pretty interesting and something to pay attention to, right? It's like, okay, like this is actually, when they're going out to sell this thing, right? They have an edge. And then as they service that customer, I can maybe feel a little bit more confidence as an investor that they're not going to get blindsided by some external threat, right? Like one of their competitors might.
Yeah. Yeah. And that does matter. Or I mean, it varies, I should say, from industry to industry. Like there's a company that I know that they're in agriculture, and you know, I'm paranoid about everything. And so I'm like, well, the food supply. And they're like, bro, we make potatoes, just calm down. So they're not super worried about it. But then we have other customers who work in the movie business, and they're like, no, the studios care very seriously about security. So our bit, like anyone who sells anything to a movie studio, in terms of a software solution, they absolutely need to be at that higher level. And so to your point, it's just sort of different across the board. That's really interesting.
Yeah. Well, and you think about how much that's evolved over time, where it's not even enough to have a solution. See, you know, I'm just thinking about like Home Depot and, you know, one of the hacks, that they underwent, where, you know, they thought they were doing everything the right way, and it was one of their suppliers' products, right, that ended up being the back door into Home Depot, right? And so it's like, it's not even enough anymore for Home Depot to do everything right, but they really have to have everybody else that they participate with, you know, have really good security implementations.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's that is an enormous complex problem. How do you deal with the supply chain of how all these different, you know, suppliers essentially integrate with each other? And I don't know if we have enough time right now to unpack that particular beast, but yeah, you're totally right. Cool, man. Well, so as we wrap up here, you're probably spending a lot of your time thinking about what's coming around the corner. So maybe my last question to you would be, you know, what do you see that's coming for, you know, for our audience here that's themselves building some of these types of solutions? They're trying to, many of them try to secure them. Where are things going in terms of investing in technology?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I wish I was more of an expert in the security space. But some things that come to mind when you ask that question. One is, there's this whole movement around no code, low code, right? So how can we empower non-programmers to be able to start automating more of their tasks? My guess is that there's probably a lot of really interesting solutions from a low code, no code perspective in the security space, right? How can you empower people that aren't dealing with security on an everyday basis to do things to make what they do more secure, right? Without having to get into the weeds of the IT infrastructure and so forth. So I think there's probably some interesting opportunities there. I also think that, and this isn't new, but there's as there are more and more connected devices out there, you know, this kind of goes back to that Home Depot problem, which is, you know, my Android phone might be somewhat secure, but like, is this the smart light bulb it's connecting to have any sort of security on it, right? And by extension, kind of all the other things that tie in and tie together. So I think that that problem just continues to grow and grow and grow as we start pulling more and more sensors to enable more software offerings. So, you know, we just made an investment in an IoT company, and it's, you know, it's something that we've thought a lot about as we evaluated that opportunity, for example.
I love it. All right. So the trends, IoT and the no code, low code. Almost sounds like you're talking about the democratization. I think that's how you say that word of coding, basically. Right. So those are cool. So hopefully people who have been listening to the show can get a little glimpse of what's coming next and how the other side of the outside capital scenario looks at it. So Peter, thank you so much for spending time today. I think our audience will definitely learn a lot from you, and it's the insights are just immensely valuable. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Ted. It was fun to be on and chat with you.
All right, great. We'll talk to you soon.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Tech Done Different podcast with Ted Harrington. If you learned something new and this conversation made you think, then share ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.